Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein with Perek Gimel of Sefer Melachim. Perek Gimel picks up where Perek Bet left off, except that we see Shlomo now in different and new lights. And these lights, early on in the Perek, already will begin to give us some sense of Shlomo's rule and what it's going to look like, what its successes will be, and what its challenges will be. So as you go through these first few psukim, we have a lot to think about. So in Pasuk Aleph, Vayichaten Shlomo et Paro Melech Mitzrayim, Paro, he marries the daughter of Paro, the king of Egypt, and he takes her and he brings her to Ir David. We'll see that in a second. But this marriage with Bat Paro is a challenging one, since she's not Jewish. There would seem to be a prohibition in the Torah against marrying non-Jews. Lo titchatein bam, you shouldn't marry them. There is some discussion in the Gemara about whether that applies only when they are still not Jewish, or whether if they convert, that would be okay. There's a debate about that. Let's assume, or we can assume perhaps, that Shlomo converted her. Her document assumes that her conversion was in fact wholehearted. But nonetheless, there are several problems. First, the Gemara's tradition is that there were no converts accepted in the times of Shlomo and David, because Shlomo and David were so powerful, and they were simply unwilling to assume that the status of the Jewish people in the world had not affected these people's impression of Judaism. And that was not acceptable in terms of those who were going to join the Am Hashem, to the Am HaNivchar. And therefore the tradition was that we wouldn't accept converts at that time. There's a similar tradition about the days of Mashiach, that we also will no longer accept converts, and that will again be because by then we will have so completely shown our place in the world that we will no longer be able to believe that people are wholehearted in their acceptance of Judaism and Jewish law and Jewish ways of life. Even if we get around that problem and assume, as Radak does, that Shlomo HaMelech broke the rules about that issue, but that Bat Paro was in fact a sincere and wholehearted convert, we're not yet out of the woods, because Bat Paro was a Mitzrit, she was an Egyptian. And there is a pasuk in the Torah that suggests, it seems to say, that we are not allowed to marry Egyptian converts until the third generation. The way the Gemara understands this is that a first generation Egyptian should marry a first generation Egyptian. Their child will be a second generation Egyptian. If that second generation Egyptian marries a second generation Egyptian, their child will be a third generation Egyptian, and that child will then be able to marry into the Jewish people. It's a complicated thing. There are other complications, other ways of doing it, but then it's an issue that has to be struggled with. Here, certainly, if she's Bat Paro, she's a first-generation Egyptian. The Radak points out that there is an opinion in the Gemara that says that that whole halacha of not marrying into the third generation only applies to males and not to females. We have a similar situation, except in Lalacha, in terms of Ammonim and Moavim, Ammonites and Moabites. We do have that in that situation. And that's why, for example, Rut, who is the progenitor of David and of Shlomo, the ancestress of them, marries Boaz, even though she was from Ammon, or Moab. I'm sorry, she was from Moab. So, the Radak suggests that perhaps this is evidence that the opinion of the Gemara that says it's only for male Mitzrim and not female Mitzrim is right, is that Shlomo does it. It also becomes interesting that it would be Shlomo doing it, because he is a descendant of Rut. However, I don't think you have to go as far as the Radak to explain this, because if one can only argue that in Shlomo's time the halacha had not yet been settled, then as long as Shlomo had a valid opinion to follow, there would be reason to believe that it would be acceptable for him to follow that opinion. So even if it was still a matter of debate, but the Sanhedrin had not yet ruled, Shlomo HaMelech would have the ability and the right to follow his opinion. Chazal, however, were clearly not thrilled about this marriage, because Chazal point out that this is, or they suggest, that this is juxtaposed. It comes right after the story with Shimi, because Shimi was the Rebbe of Shlomo HaMelech. He was the teacher of Shlomo HaMelech. And as long as he was alive, Shlomo HaMelech did not marry Bat Paro. Now that already suggests that the stronger Torah opinion, or the more traditional Torah opinion, even in Shlomo HaMelech's time, would have been not to marry Bat Paro. However, it didn't hold the day. That also sheds new light on yesterday's Perek, when Shlomo was making deals with Shimi and restricting him and things like that. It interestingly contrasts with the status of Shimi as his Rebbe. If Shimi is his Rebbe, you would think that Shlomo HaMelech would have to treat him in different kinds of ways. So the fact that he doesn't is interesting in and of itself. So you have this marriage to Bat Paro. Then the next part of the pasuk is Vayviel Il David. He brings her to the city of David to live there until he finishes building his house and Hashem's house and the walls of Jerusalem. So that's another theme that we'll find in Shlomo's life, the theme of building. Certainly building the Beit HaMikdash is one of his greatest accomplishments. And yet we see Shlomo very concerned with building and very focused on building. A theme or an idea to keep in mind, we'll see it more, and as it comes up more, we'll have to think about whether it was a wholly positive thing or whether it contained within it some challenges as well. So Pasuk Gimel notes for us, notes for us that the people were still sacrificing on private altars because there was no central place of worship, no Beit HaMikdash yet. As Rashi and Radak note, it was permissible at that time to sacrifice on these private altars. There was nothing wrong with it. The Pasuk noting it, however, I think, shows us that it has laid the seeds again for what will become a continuing challenge. Because certainly throughout the first part of Sefer Melachim, throughout the early kings of Yehuda, the primary challenge of the Pesukim note is that the people are still sacrificing on the Bamot. So even after the Beit HaMikdash is built, their connection to sacrifice is so strong, they're unwilling to forego, and at least in Chazal's reading, these Bamot were the Shem Hashem. Later on, the people also start worshipping idols. That's a whole different challenge. But here, just the challenge of getting used to sacrificing only in the Beit HaMikdash is one that I think we lay the grounds, the seeds for here by noting that the people are still sacrificing on the Bamot. Pasuk Gimel shows how this problem or issue already had worked its way into the palace as well, because Pasuk notes, "Vayehav Shlomo et Hashem alecha b'chukot avir aviv, rak b'mamot u'mizabeach u'maktir." Shlomo loves Hashem to follow all the ways of David, or the ways of David his father, except that Shlomo is also sacrificing in Bamot. Now again, at that time it was permissible, so why does the Pasuk note it? So Radak notes that David didn't, or Radak has a tradition that David did not sacrifice in Bamot, that when David wanted to sacrifice to Hashem, he always went to the central place of worship, whatever it was at the time, Givon or Shiloh, or wherever it may have been. And then the Pasuk Dalet, Shlomo HaMelech goes himself, Vayelech HaMelech Givon al Mizbeach Hashem, Ki hi habama hagidola elef olot, Yaleh Shlomo al Mizbeach Hahu. He goes to Givon, and he offers 1,000 offerings, 1,000 olot. This actually contains two themes in it. First is the whole issue of sacrifice. We see Shlomo now being so connected to sacrifice that he, in distinction to his father's tradition, offers wherever he's allowed to. And when he goes to Givon, the central Mizbeach, he offers there 1,000 olot. That's an excessive number. It's a huge number. And it's a number worth considering because the topic of excess will certainly play a continuing role in Shlomo HaMelech's life. Did he think that 1,000 olot was twice as good as 500 olot? Four times as good as 250 olot? 1,000 times as good as one olah? So that whole attitude is one that bears watching. It's not in and itself sinful, but it does suggest the seeds of a misunderstanding of what korbanot are all about, and that is something that I think we'll see later in Shlomo HaMelech's life. Pasuk Hey, Bigivon Nira Hashem El Shlomo B'chol HaMalayla V'yom Elokim She'al Ma'etel Lach. Shlomo HaMelech has a dream, and in the dream God appears to him and says, "What do you want? Ask it. What should I give you?" V'yom Shlomo, Atasita im Abdecha David Avi Chesed Gadol. Shlomo opens up by saying, "You've done so well by my father David. You did a great kindness as he went before you in truth and in charity or in justice and with a pure heart towards you. And you have held that for him. In other words, you've rewarded that chesed by what? By giving him a son who sits on his throne this day. So, and now I'm king in the place of my father David. I am a young man. I don't really know what's going on." It's interesting that we say this here because depending on where you place this, some place this earlier. But we've already seen Shlomo effectively deal with Shimi, effectively deal with Yoav, effectively deal with Adoniyahu. So it's possible that this came earlier, that's what some before Shim say, or it happens now after 3 years on the throne, and Shlomo still feels that he's very young. the way I will note the tradition of Chazal, that Shlomo Melech was 12, which would make him a Na'ar Katon, when he took over the throne, even if he was already 15 here, he'd done it after Shimi was killed and after he married Bat Paro, even then he's still very young. But the number 12 is worth noting also because that means that Chazal assumed that Shlomo Melech bore his son Rechavam, who ruled after him at the age of 11, because Shlomo Melech rules for 40 years, and Rechavam is 41 when he takes over. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in the Sefer Melachim with chronology. There are many chronological issues that become problematic on their own, and problematic in comparison to Divrei Hayamim. There are commentators on it, where I can mention it briefly, I will, where I cannot, I'll leave it for another time, but so the chronology in Sefer Melachim is an issue. I don't think it's a central issue, because I think as we go through the book, we'll see that Sefer Melachim is not meant primarily as history. It's meant primarily as history of a certain kind of the history of the Jewish people in terms of their kings and their relationship to Avodat Hashem, the relationship to the service of God, as we'll see in the coming parakim. So now Shlomo HaMelech is talking to Hashem, and he says, "Vavdecha b'toch amecha Hashem acharta, here I am, I'm ruling among the people you have chosen, an Am Rav, a great multitudinous nation, there are many of them, Hashalim Anevali Sefer Meirov. You cannot count them, there are so many of them." We're going to see at the end of Parak Daled that phrase will be repeated. The emphasis that there are many, many Jews. We're never told exactly how many, they don't have a firm census. There are many, many Jews that Shlomo HaMelech finds that daunting. That idea of many, though, is also part of this theme of excess that I pointed out. So Shlomo points it out, however, for a positive reason. He says in Pasuk Tet, "V'natata l'avdecha leiv shomea lishpot et amecha l'avid ben tov l'ra, ki mi yuchal lishpot et amecha hakaven hazeh." So I'm praying to you, you asked me for something, give me a heart that will be able to hear and judge your nation, to understand the difference between good and evil, because who can judge your heavy, mighty, weighty nation? So the question of who can judge them in terms of weightiness is either possible to take literally, or it's possible to suggest along the lines of Chazal that judging the Jewish people is more difficult because judges are held responsible for errors that they make in a way that would not be true among other nations. So that's what Shlomo wants, also revealing to us, by the way, that in the times of Shlomo HaMelech, the king was a court of some sort as well. This is an interesting theory in terms of the Ran in the Drashot HaRan, picking that up in the 14th century. The Ran suggests that there was such a thing as Din Melech, the laws of the king and the judgments of the king, and that those were not necessarily exactly the same as the Torah's procedures for law. That's an interesting question of its own, the whole idea of whether the system of law the Torah prescribes was meant to be the system that rules society, or whether it was supposed to be one part of a system, as the Ran suggests, with the king perhaps setting up a completely different legislative program and legislating different kinds of procedures for capturing and punishing evildoers. Supposing it tells Vaitama Devar Hashem, Ki Sha'al Shlomo and the Devar Hazeh. Hashem is pleased that Shlomo asks this, and so therefore Vayomer Elokim Elav, since you asked for this, and you did not ask for length of days, you didn't ask for wealth, you didn't ask for victory over your enemies, all reasonable requests for a king to ask, and what you asked for was to be able to understand the judge appropriately, I'm going to do like you said. Now you're going to have wisdom and understanding to judge. This suggests that whatever David HaMelech said when he told his son he was a smart boy, the Shlomo now leaps to another level of wisdom and with God's gift. There has never been somebody as wise as you, and there never will be somebody as wise as you. I will note, however, that Hashem only gives him a heart to judge and to understand. It's not necessarily true, and so the Rambam sees it this way, so the others see it this way, that having a brilliance and intelligence helps one conquer all of one's challenges in life, since after all, as we'll see in several places, Shlomo HaMelech falls prey to certain ideas, sometimes even because of his wisdom, he thinks that he'll be able to avoid certain challenges. So apparently, we're being taught also, partially,
that wisdom does not conquer everything, or intelligence, whatever Hashem gives Shlomo HaMelech, is not what will conquer all of our challenges in life. But then Hashem says, "V'gam Asher lo she'alta natati lach, gam okshir gam kavod, Asher lo yach kamocha ish b'melachim koya becha." I'm also going to give you what you did not ask for, wealth and honor, and you will be like no other king has been all of your days. V'im te'lech b'drachai, and so those are unconditional. Those are being given now without a condition. And if you follow my ways, Pasuk Yudalet says, "Lishmor chukai mitzvotai, kasher alakta min avicha, v'harachti et yamecha." But the blessing of length of days is one that will only come if you follow my ways to keep my laws, statutes, judgments, whatever the laws are, as David HaMelech did, and then I will give you length of days. So if Shlomo rules, by the way, at a young age, Chazal think 12, so that he feels young, whatever young is defined as, and he only is king for 40 years, it would seem that his length of days never came true. And that will be because, as we'll see later on, at the end of his life, the Pesukim find fault in Shlomo over something that he does. But in Pasuk Tevav, he's still young. Vayikat Shlomo v'hinei chalom. He wakes up and it was a dream. That's an interesting thing of its own, the whole question of when and how people who have encounters with God know what they are and what they're not, know whether it's the door or not to hear. Shlomo HaMelech wakes up and he sees it as a dream, but it's a dream that has come true, Chazal say, and the Mefarshim say. So the way of Yerushalayim, he comes to Jerusalem, he was in Gibeon where the altar was, and he stands there, Vayamod if the Aron Brit Hashem, he stands before the Aron, the two are not yet connected to each other, Vayal Olot, and he offers sacrifices, Vayas Shlamim, and he makes peace offerings, some peace offerings. The difference between Shlamim and Olot is that Shlamim, there's a part of it that goes to the Kohanim, and a part of it that goes to regular people. And he uses it, Vayas Mishtel Chol Avadav. And he makes a big party for all of his servants. And the idea of celebratory meals is certainly well established and well framed within Judaism. But I just think it's also interesting to watch that when Shlomo wants to express thanks to God, so David HaMelech, when he wanted to express thanks to God, writes Tehillim, writes songs, expresses himself in that way. Shlomo's expression of his religious connection to God is through Olot and Shlamim. They will distress it because Olot and Shlamim and sacrifices in general will be crucial in the end of Shlomo's life, as in the end of Shlomo's life. Pasuk Tet Zayin, Az Tavon Ashtayim Nashim Zorot El HaMelech V'Tamon Lefanav, two probably prostitutes come to Shlomo and they stand before him for judgment. How do we live together in one house? We both gave birth in that house. And I gave birth, and 3 days later, she gave birth too. And we are the only two in the house. Nobody else lives there. There was just the two of us. And this woman who's giving the story, claims, this other woman rolled over her son and smothered her child, her baby. I know what I thought it was a son. It's children. They give birth to children. Maybe later on we'll say that it's a son. Yes, it's a son. So the claim is, the fact is that one of the babies is dying, one of the babies is still alive. The woman making the claim now claims that the woman whose son died had smothered her son in her sleep, and the next pasuk, "Vatako b'toch halayla v'tikachat b'ni be'etzli," she gets up in the night, takes my son from me, "V'matkai shinan," I'm sleeping, "V'tashkiveu b'chikah," she puts him in her arms, "V'en b'nahamei tashkiveu b'chikah," she puts the dead baby in my arms. So the claim is, I woke up one morning, I found a dead baby in my arms, but it's not my dead baby. I woke up to nurse my child, and he is not with us. So when it got to be light, and I could see, I looked at him. And it was not my son to whom I had given birth. So her claim is not just, I know my baby didn't die. Her claim is, I'm looking at the kid, and I can tell already. I know this kid for 3 days. I know him. That's an interesting question of its own. You have that with twins, you always wonder how the parents are sure that which twin is which and whether they ever got them mixed up. But here the woman is at least claiming, I know my child. Presumably there's not enough of a difference between the children that anybody could tell. It's not like one woman was what we call today African American, was darker skin, and one woman was lighter skin, or one baby, or whatever. They were reasonably similar babies. And this other woman claims, but I knew it. But to Reisha Acheret, the other woman says, Lochi, if my son is alive, you're wrong. You walk up with a dead baby, you're trying to avoid the consequences, you're trying to avoid the tragedy. And it's not true. They're going back and forth, each one claiming the other story. But that's what they say before the king. And as we see in the later of the parak, the people are watching this. Everybody's there. So this is a challenge for Shlomo to prove his mettle. Part of what a king has to do is prove to the people that he is able to judge them and to serve as their king. And in Pasuk of Gimel, the king says, he repeats their testimony. It's almost as if he is befuddled by what to do. It is, after all, a problem in halacha. If two people come into court and they make the exact opposite claims and they cannot both be right, what do you do? So perhaps an interesting piece of background is that in Dine Mamonot, in civil law, in halacha, the answer is that we split it. If we have no way of telling, then we split it. If there's no, well, it's more than that. If there's no prior possessor. So in this case, it perhaps would have been able to argue that the woman who came into court holding the live baby has possession of the live baby. And then, theoretically, you would say, the person who's trying to make a claim would have to bring proof. That would be one option. The other option is to suggest that neither of them had control, and then you would split it. That is the first Mishnah in Bava Metzia, although it's a complicated topic, but two people come in holding on to something, so they're both in possession, and they both claim it. So in those cases, we would split it. So Shlomo Melech seems unsure as what to do. So in Pasuk of Dalet, the king says, they need a sword. And they bring a sword to the king. He says, let's split it up. Give me the sword, cut the baby in half, the live baby, and give each woman a half a baby. So this is a complicated thing for Shlomo to claim. And we have to assume that it's only because he knows what the reaction will be, that he never actually meant to do this. But then the reactions are odd too, because in Pasuk Vav, the woman says, "V'tomer ha'isha asher bina ha'chay ala melech, ki nichmeru rachameha al bina." The live woman, whose son is alive, the woman whose son is alive, says to the king, because after all she has mercy, she has compassion over her son. "V'tomer bi'adoni, tenu la et ha'yalun ha'chay v'ameit al timitu." She says, "Please, king, please, my master, give her the live baby and don't kill him." The other one says, "Neither one of us will have it. Go ahead, kill the baby." It's a very complicated pasuk. First of all, Chazal are not sure that this would have been good enough proof for Shlomo to do what he does, to say, "Now I know who won," and then a bat call, a heavenly voice comes out at the time and declares that Shlomo was in fact right. But here too, you wonder, or speaking for the 21st century, you wonder about the woman who said, "All right, cut him up." So granted that she wasn't the mother of this baby, you have to assume that she was so distraught over the death of her son that she decided that in her bitterness, she was willing to cause somebody else misery as well, to no real purpose. Meaning she won't have anything. So it portrays her in an inhumane light, even by the standards of that she just lost a baby. Granted that she lost a baby, and granted that that's terrible, she is willing to let somebody else lose a baby just in the name of having the woman lose a baby. She had tried to get that baby from her. If she couldn't get a baby, a live baby, she didn't care what happened. It's an odd thing. It's an odd thing to see. It's just hard to relate to evil like that of that level, to insensitivity, to jealousy, to cruelty of that level. In any case, Shlomo HaMelech is not going to go through with it. That wasn't the point. Vayad HaMelech, Vayomer Tenu La Teyelun HaChayev HaMeit Lo Tumitu, he says, give the baby to the woman who said, leave him alone. because it's her son. And so Chazal assumed that this back call, this heavenly voice, ratified the correctness of Shlomo's judgment. Although again, it could have been not that way. It could have been that theoretically it could have been that the compassionate woman was simply compassionate. It could have been theoretically, having lost the baby, she knew how terrible it was, and she had tried to steal the baby. Once she saw it wasn't going to work, she felt bad. To go as far to steal a baby is one thing, but to go as far as to have the baby killed because you weren't trying to steal it, so that's a whole other level. So it's theoretically possible, would have been possible, that the fake mother says, let him live, and the real mother, who doesn't think that's what's going to happen, who thinks she's lost, and if she's going to lose the baby, she doesn't want somebody else to have the pleasure of raising him, so she says, kill him. So theoretically it could have been possible. Again, Chazal think that a backlog came out and said it wasn't possible. But it shows the difficulty of the story. Equally as interesting to me, I think, is that it's a story that only can work once, to some extent. Because to the extent that people then hear this story and know this story, so we know the trick. And once you know the trick, then it can't be. So, you know, if you said to me, if you were in that situation, would you ever say, let's smite everybody because I don't want the other person to have it? I would say no, because that would reveal that I'm evil and I would probably lose, because people would assume that I'm not telling the truth. But I only say that because I know the story here with Shlomo HaMelech. So in this parak, we see Shlomo HaMelech doing that, doing this patent, as I would say in Hebrew, a trick, a ruse, but it's a ruse that really can only work once until you're far enough away from that ruse that maybe the people involved won't realize what's going on. The same thing I think is true of Shlomo's discussion with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Givon, in the dream. Shem says, what do you want? So, let's presume or assume that Hashem knows that Shlomo is sincere when he asked for wisdom. But it's still true that knowing Shlomo's story and that Hashem gave him everything, so from then on, to some extent, making the right choice is a suspicious choice, because we might wonder whether the person making the right choice is hoping or assuming that he'll get everything else. If to some extent, if somebody chooses whether to do mitzvot or not, they're doing it for the right reason, could be. They may also be doing it because they actually have a firm belief that by doing mitzvot, Hashem will give them long days or wealth or whatever is promised in the Torah for doing mitzvot in general. Here too with Shlomo, so Shlomo, let's assume that Hashem knows is telling the truth. But that whole idea, if Hashem came to you in a dream and said, what do you want? You'd be likely to pick something that would put you in a virtuous light, even if you weren't fully virtuous, just because you know this story, you know that it's better to look virtuous, even if you're not yet virtuous. So Shlomo Melech's wisdom here in Perek Gimel is an interesting kind, because it also reveals that it's in a very early stage of human history in terms of morality and ethics and good and evil and worship God and things like that. In any case, in this situation, it works. And in Pasuk Chaf Chet, the last of our Perek, Vayishmu Chol Yisrael et Amishpat HaShashavat HaMelech Vayiru B'Pidi HaMelech. They see the judgment that he has, and then, interesting thing, that by Yerubim Tehamelach, they fear the king. Because they see that he has the true wisdom of God to judge them. And Chazal think they're worried now to judge them because they don't know how far that judgment goes. In this case, he managed to figure out what happened in the bedroom in the middle of the night between these two people, these two mothers. They're worried then that maybe he really knows how to judge them all sorts of ways. There's a certain amount of fear there. I like to note that we're not always comfortable with those who are extremely, extremely talented. It unsettles us to a certain extent, and it makes us worry to a certain extent. In this case, in a positive way, because we can assume that once they had this fear of Shlomo, it made Shlomo's task of judging them and of guiding them in the right paths that much easier. But in general, it's a challenge. It also explains why the next pasuk of the traditional division of Tanakh is part of this section, even though it's part of chapter 4, because it talks about Shlomo HaMelech being king and having a well-established kingship. It is the wisdom that he displays that then most firmly establishes his kingship over the Jewish people. So we'll stop here. Perek Dalet is a short parak, so tomorrow's shiur might be shorter than we're used to, but we'll see you tomorrow. Bezrat Hashem. This is Gideon Rothstein. Have a good day.